Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English to Africa service of The Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clotty in Washington, D.C.
We'll have to watch how the process plays out, but it's difficult to see that it alone is going to change the approach. As I said, the president believes the approach we have been taking has been getting results, and we're going to keep at that.
The White House reacts to the preliminary ruling by the UN's International Court of Justice. We'll have a report.
We will be opening for 2 days over the coming weekend. All diplomatic missions are going to serve as registration stations. So in the U.S., obviously, we have a mission in New York, as well as the embassy in Washington.
South Africa's Electoral Commission calls on citizens abroad to register to vote in the coming national elections.
We have a very unique relationship with the continent. Our people-to-people ties is unique, and it's our strength. And so the diaspora is our source of strength, and so we're now looking at ways in which we can officially codify that strength.
And the U.S. government sends a delegation to the ongoing African Nations Cup, or AFCON, now underway in Ivory Coast. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. The White House says the preliminary order by the International Court of Justice that Israel must take urgent action to prevent genocide in Gaza is consistent with the Biden administration's approach to the war and will not change U.S. policy supporting Israel. White House Bureau Chief Patsy Wyder-Kuswara has this report.
As the death toll surpasses 26,000 people, according to Gaza health officials, a UN court ordered Israel to take urgent action to prevent genocide in the Palestinian enclave. President of the International Court of Justice, Joan E. Donoghue.
In particular, A, killing members of the group, B, causing serious bodily or mental harm to members of the group, C, deliberately inflicting on the group conditions of life calculated to bring about its physical destruction.
South Africa brought the case against Israel to the International Court of Justice. The White House says the case is meritless and the ruling will not change staunch U.S. support for Israel. National Security Council spokesperson John Kirby told VOA.
We'll have to watch how the process plays out, but it's difficult to see that it alone is going to change the approach. As I said, the president believes the approach we have been taking has been getting results, and we're going to keep at that.
Washington says the ruling is consistent with the administration's approach to urge Israel to minimize civilian harm and increase humanitarian aid, and that Israel has the right to ensure an attack does not happen again. Despite mounting casualties, Washington is against a ceasefire that it says will only benefit Hamas, and notes the ICJ order did not call for one. Ned Lazarus, professor of conflict analysis at George Washington University, via Skype.
And in that sense, it is classifying Israel's military operation in general as a legitimate military operation in response to the Hamas attack of October 7th.
Still, the ICJ ruling may compel the U.S. and other countries to examine whether their support for Israel's military campaign carries a legal risk. Adil Haq, professor of international law at Rutgers University, via Skype.
The fact that the court has alerted the international community of a risk that genocide may be taking place or may take place if not prevented, means that every state who is providing military or diplomatic support for Israel needs to seriously consider whether they should continue to do so despite the risks that the court has identified.
Whether an ICJ decision is enforceable against the United States has never been litigated. But diplomatically, the ICJ ruling emboldens those pushing for action against Israel at the UN Security Council, something Washington must eventually deal with. Palestinian ambassador to the UN Riyad Mansour says he is already working with Algeria as the Arab UNSC member.
We are digging into all the details in order to take the appropriate steps, which of course these steps will be in the Security Council.
While international pressure may not sway President Joe Biden ahead of the November election, he would need to heed his own voters.
Biden, you are
polls show a majority of Americans, especially those from Biden's own Democratic Party, want the Gaza war to end. Patsy Widakuswara, VOA News, Washington.
In South Africa, the Electoral Commission is calling on citizens abroad to register to vote in the coming national elections. This, as it compiles a voter list to be used for the polls. It comes after the electoral body enabled an online registration platform that, for the first time, allows citizens abroad to register for this year's elections. The electoral body expressed hope that the online registration process will attract prospective voters abroad to register. For more information, I reach Sayama Mabolo. He is the Chief Electoral Officer of the Electoral Commission of South Africa.
Well, the big issue really at the moment is that we will be opening for 2 days over the coming weekend. All diplomatic missions are going to serve as registration stations. So in the U.S., obviously, we have a mission in New York as well as the embassy in Washington. South Africans who are living in the U.S. are then invited to come and enlist themselves on the voter's roll so that when election date is proclaimed, they can vote in the election and really contribute to shaping the political direction of the country by taking part in the elections.
So far, what has been the responses of South African prospective voters in terms of registration to participate in the election, and what are your hopes of those in the diaspora to register as well?
Since December, we launched an online registration portal, and it's been a hive of activity because since the launch until today, we have 18,000 South Africans who have used the portal, and there is significant interest from the U.S. indeed. You know, we're seeing close to 2,000 South Africans living in the U.S. have used the facility. But our view is that there may be many more who we need to reach, and this weekend is an opportunity for that. Even if they still use the online portal, and those that are nearer Washington and New York can go to the mission. So it's a big, big opportunity because they have the right to participate in the election, and that right is conferred to them in terms of the Constitution.
Will you say the Electoral Commission will be ready to administer credible elections when it's due?
No, we have no doubt. We have no doubt, Peter, that we will be in a position to give the country a credible electoral process. We're working hard to ensure that come election day, whenever the date is, because it's currently not announced, whenever it's proclaimed, we are ready and we offer South Africans a credible electoral process.
Mr. Mamabolo, what is the Electoral Commission's core message to the people of South Africa, prospective voters, particularly in South Africa and in the diaspora, about the coming elections?
Our message is simple, is that we have a democracy that has been 30 years in the making. It is important that every one of us participate in the democratic process, and an election is an important component of the democratic process. So we say it is your democracy, own it. But you own it by participating, by making a mark on the ballot, for whichever party you think best stands the chance of shaping our country to prosperity.
Well, I understand this election is going to be competitive. How ready is the Electoral Commission to handle any dispute if it arises?
Yes, indeed. Because elections are highly contested and the profound interests that are found in elections, we have our own internal mechanisms for dealing with objections. We have an office for electoral offenses, and there are legal firms that work with us in that office. But we also have, as part of our legislative architecture, we also have the Electoral Court, which reviews the decisions that the Commission made. And it is also an arbiter when it comes to offenses that arise from the transgression of the Electoral Code of Conduct. So all that institutional architecture is in place already. And should there be issues, offices in that architecture will be able to determine whatever issues there may be.
Sia Mamabolo is the Chief Electoral Officer of the Electoral Commission of South Africa. He spoke with me from the capital, Pretoria. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken has wrapped up a four-country tour of democracy-supporting countries in Africa, meeting with Angolan leaders to highlight increasing cooperation on a railway infrastructure project. VOA senior diplomatic correspondent Cindy Sain reports.
Secretary of State Antony Blinken wrapped up his tour of Africa Thursday, saying the U.S. seeks more common ground and a shared future with democratic countries on the continent, including Angola.
At the White House in November, President Biden reaffirmed to President Lorenzo that this is a historic moment for the partnership between the United States and Angola. Our relationship is stronger, it's more consequential, it's farther reaching than in any point in our 30-year friendship. And at this transformational moment, President Biden asked me to come to Luanda to help build on and accelerate our progress.
In Angola's capital, Blinken reviewed what he said was faster than expected work on the Lobito Corridor Railway, connecting the country with the Democratic Republic of Congo and Zambia. It is the most ambitious U.S. infrastructure project on a continent where China has long been engaged in similar massive endeavors, says Africa expert Terry McCulley with the United States Institute of Peace.
The U.S. is investing significantly in Angola. The Lobito Corridor project, which will link Angola to DRC and Zambia, is the largest U.S. public investment in Africa in decades. And I think that's a signal that the U.S. wants to be engaged and a strong partner of African countries.
McCulley says the United States aims to show that it is a long-term partner at a time when Russia is ramping up its security ties with military-run states in Africa, and China is expanding its footprint through investment in infrastructure.
You see a resurgence in Russian efforts to influence in Africa, particularly through disinformation campaigns. China obviously is a very important player on the African continent. And let's be honest, the Africans value that relationship because China and Chinese companies have contributed a lot to the needed infrastructure projects that are essential for development.
Asked about partnering with the U.S. as opposed to Russia and China, Angola's foreign minister, Tete Antonio, had a diplomatic answer, saying, "The best friend is the one that tells the truth." Blinken also praised Angola's peace efforts on the continent.
Angola is trusted by all sides. President Lorenzo's leadership is vital for a breakthrough.
President Joe Biden has said he is eager to visit Africa, but Blinken noted that the U.S. election imposes time constraints on him this year. Cindy Sain, VOA News.
The U.S. government sent a delegation to the ongoing African Nations Cup, or AFCON, now underway in Ivory Coast. The delegation includes top U.S. athletes such as Chinyenye Ogum, a two-time women's national basketball star, Lisa Leslie, four-time Olympic gold medalist and basketball Hall of Famer, Crystal Dunn, U.S. women's national soccer team star, Danielle Kimege, Principal Deputy Coordinator at the Global Engagement Center, and Denise Laurent Mante, the Executive Director of the Presidential Advisory Council on African Diaspora Engagement in the United States. Experts say it's the first U.S. official delegation to Africa's premier football tournament. For more information on the Presidential Advisory Council on African Diaspora Engagement in the United States, I sat down with Denise Laurent Mante. Here's part one of the conversation.
We were looking for a way of us to really engage the diaspora, the African diaspora, to be specific, and find a way to bring them involved in the summit. And so, you know, a number of colleagues and I kind of, you know, put our heads together at the time. I was a director for Africa at the White House, working on the summit. And so we thought about ways in which we could bring in the diaspora, but also create something that was substantive to really just, I think, officially find a way to work with the diaspora to strengthen our partnership between U.S. officials and the global African diaspora. And so we codified a specific engagement event during the summit. The vice president spoke at the African Diaspora Young Leaders Forum, which is a part of the summit, and then announced that we will create a council that would be included of members of, you know, 12 individuals to advise the president on ways in which we can engage the diaspora community writ large, you know, work on different initiatives, different programs. And so that was the creation of the council, myself and some colleagues and I at the White House. And of course, it was an interagency effort, as we say, mm-hmm. among the U.S. government, working with different agencies across the government, State Department, Department of Commerce, USTR, et cetera, to really put together a platform and a framework for the U.S. to officially engage the diaspora, you know, within our government landscape and of course, our foreign policy landscape.
This appears to be different. Is it a new way of the White House looking at Africa in a different perspective and engaging the continent and its diaspora?
When it comes to the United States, we have a very unique relationship with the continent, right? Our people-to-people ties is unique, and it's our strength. And so the diaspora is our source of strength. And so we're now looking at ways in which we can officially codify that strength, right, within our U.S. government framework and say, we have an African diaspora, right? You know, African immigrants, those who came here through the slave trade, right? They are a part of the diaspora. It's our strength. It's our way for us to really work on people-to-people engagement. And so it's not new, but I would say that it's a way that we are looking to amplify that aspect of our foreign policy.
I saw you a few times engaging in investment forums where you shared your thoughts. How has been the response from the African diaspora so far?
Yeah, and so, you know, I look at Ghana, where my family's from. Great example when it comes to diaspora engagement. You'll see that in the past, I would say about 3 to 4 years, there's been a major push, this, you know, return to home, campaign that you know, the government of Ghana has been running. And it's really a call for members of the diaspora to go back home, to invest, right, to reconnect with their ties. And I think that this is the time. We're in a very unique time frame where, you know, there was a number of articles, and it said that, one, the world is becoming more African.
Right.
And it's true. The world is becoming more African. You know, we all know the statistics, right, with the youth balls, the population trends, you know, the world is becoming more African. And so what better way to leverage those people-to-people ties to encourage the diaspora, where we have a unique, specific relationship with our African partners, to say, if you want to start a business, look at the continent. Right. It draws you back to your history, and it's an opportunity for you to also build your business. And so we're encouraging the diaspora to start businesses on the continent. You know, we're encouraging educational exchange programs. These are all things that, like I said before, it really plays to our strength in the United States. Right. That culture aspect, you know, the people to people ties. And so I think it's a great opportunity for the diaspora to go back to the continent.
Do you think your office has come to stay with the U.S. looking at a stronger partnership with countries on the continent? Do you see it?
I mean, I would surely hope so. You know, I think, like I said before, I think it's definitely necessary. You know, the time is right. There's lots of investment on the continent. Diaspora, there, all of the investment opportunities has not gone unnoticed by the diaspora, right? And so it's a unique opportunity, unique time frame. The way our council is established is that it's actually established within the State Department. And so, you know, it's institutionalized within the State Department. And so most of our staff from the council itself are State Department employees. Now, the council members itself, the 12-person council, they'll rotate every 2 years. You know, just to give, I think, a different opportunity for different people in different sectors to participate and provide recommendations. But the council itself is institutionalized within the Department of State.
So talk to me. You just returned from Ivory Coast.
Yes.
Where you watched some matches at the ongoing AFCON. Mm-hmm. I understand this is the first time officially that the U.S. has sent a delegation to the AFCON or the African Nations Cup. How was it for you going back to Ivory Coast?
Yeah.
And what did you experience
there? You know, it was an amazing trip, and I think a very unique one because, you know, it was a sports delegation that we sent back. Typically, when we send delegations, it's, you know, to focus on different aspects, but this was for sports. Mm-hmm. And sports diplomacy is great, one, because it's sports is a unifying factor. It brings people together. Mm-hmm. And when we're talking about strengthening people-to-people ties, what better way to showcase that than sports? Mm-hmm. And, you know, the Africa Cup of Nations has, you know, a wide number of countries, you know, competing each other. There are different countries that are represented there. And so we thought, you know, for our first event of the council for the year, why not bring together some athletes who are part of the diaspora, you know, with a few U.S. officials, travel to Abidjan. We attended the opening ceremony, which was amazing, by the way. Phenomenal production. The opening match was amazing. But then we also took the time to meet with some young leaders. The athletes hosted some sports clinics, basketball clinics, soccer clinics, you know, with young women. And coincidentally, the delegation was full of almost women.
Denise Laurent-Manté is Executive Director of the Presidential Advisory Council on African Diaspora Engagement. She spoke with me from here in Washington. Join us on Sunday for the conclusion of the conversation. The government of Lesotho has endorsed Joshua Setipa as the kingdom's candidate for the position of Secretary General of the Commonwealth of Nations. It makes Setipa the first Mosotho to compete to be the head of the organization. He is a former Minister of Trade and Industry in Lesotho. Observers say Setipa appears to be heavily favored for the position. This after the Mountain Kingdom launched lobbying efforts within the Southern African Development Community, or SADC, and other parts of the continent to support its candidate. Local media reports say Setipa faces stiff competition from candidates from Ghana and Tanzania. For more on what his candidacy means for the country and his prospect of success, I reached Joshua Setipa.
I was humbled. I was very, very happy to hear that, and also grateful for that honor, because it is not an easy decision that any country takes. And for a country like Lesotho, it's not always that Lesotho puts up candidates. In fact, I think in recent memory, at this level, I don't recall any candidate ever being endorsed. So it is a big deal. It is something that not only humbled me, but also made me grateful for the level of support and the level of confidence that the government and the people that the government of Lesotho represents, that the people of Lesotho have put in me. I've been receiving many, many messages of encouragement from people from all walks of life.
The question a lot of people are asking is, are you equipped to handle the job if you were to be selected or chosen as the next General Secretary of the Commonwealth of Nations?
I am, of all the candidates, the only one that has had the opportunity to lead an international organization. I was the managing director. In fact, I was the first managing director of the UN Technology Bank and support least developed countries address their science, technology, and innovation issues. So I spent almost 10 years at the World Trade Organization, at the highest level of that organization. Well, I was a cabinet minister. I have the political skills to engage at the highest level in any forum, engaging with heads of state, engaging with prime ministers, engaging with ministers, with the sensitivity and the political skill that is required. I have also, of course, worked in the region, on the ground, in the Commonwealth. I worked for the World Bank in West Africa. I've worked in Southern Africa as a trade policy advisor at the SADC Secretariat. I've worked in the Caribbean on banana issues in the Caribbean and cotton issues also in West Africa and East Africa. I've worked in the Pacific. So I have hands-on experience in implementing programs, in delivering programs, and of course in working with all stakeholders, not just governments. So I can confidently say that I have the hands-on experience, and none of the candidates that have been put so far, I do not believe that they have more experience than I have. And I must also add that they are highly accomplished people in their own right. But I believe that I have more hands-on experience, and therefore I am more qualified for this role.
As the first Mosotho to compete for this position and have the backing of the entire country, what will this mean to you if you are chosen or selected as the next General Secretary of the Commonwealth of Nations to take over from Ms. Patricia Scotland?
Well, for Lesotho, this is going to be a very, very big development. It will go down in history as a recognition that one of us was good enough and had the confidence of 2.5 billion people to be at their service and to provide and contribute to the development of the Commonwealth nations. And that, I think, is number one. Number two, it also says to us as Basotho that the world has recognized our contribution or the potential also contribute like other countries are doing to the global system. So if one of us is part of that, that is the recognition that Lesotho has taken its seat around the table with other nations to collectively contribute towards the betterment of humanity. So it is a recognition that will go down in history as a milestone. But also more than anything, it also sends a very positive message to other Basotho young chaps, young boys and girls that are still going through the education system and that aspire to be leaders in their own right, that it is actually possible that someone can come from the mountains of Lesotho and be accorded this responsibility and play this role and actually deliver on this role, which from where they sit, it looks very far, it looks very unachievable. But for me, more than anything, it's going to encourage those that aspire that anything is possible. Everything is possible, irrespective of which country, which village, which community you come from. And that, I think, is for me the most important part of this, that it's going to motivate young boys and girls to know that the sky is the limit. Where you're born has nothing to do with what you can achieve in life.
Joshua Setipa is the Lesotho-backed Commonwealth of Nations candidate. He spoke with me from London. You are listening to Nightline Africa on the English to Africa service of The Voice of America. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington, D.C. And coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa, the Saturday music spot from our collection of music from the continent. But first, the General Secretary of the ruling Malawi Congress Party, or MCP, says the group plans to endorse incumbent President Lazarus Chakwera as its presidential candidate for the next general election. This after Isinenhawa Mkaka rejected an online survey saying it is opposition propaganda aimed at damaging the president's popularity ahead of the general election in 2025. The poll, which has since been circulating on social media, shows the president with 15% support. But Isinenhawa Mkaka tells me that the poll does not reflect the true picture on the ground.
Who conducted the survey? And what was the sample size, for example? And what was the confidence level in as far as this survey was concerned? These and many more questions need to be answered. I've never heard that anybody was conducting a research of that nature. That said, let's assume that they indeed conducted the research. I would question the results because in as far as I'm concerned, Dr. Lazarus Chakwera, the president of the Republic of Malawi, has been gaining ground by the day. He is sweeping the voters off their feet. What Dr. Chakwera is doing currently is convincing Malawians that this is the leader that they needed.
What do you say to supporters of the main opposition party, DPP, who say that the president has failed to keep all the promises he made? For which reason people of Malawi decided to back him and vote for him to become the president?
Well, that would be perceptual generalization. To say that he has failed to keep all the promises, to me, I think that's not true. Because you look at the road infrastructure that he's carrying out, which is a fulfillment of his campaign promises. And you look at the completion of pieces of infrastructure, which were started by the previous regime, which was his campaign promise. He promised that, unlike the other presidents before him, who abandoned the projects that were started by previous governments, he would, once elected, he would make sure that he completed this project, and he's doing exactly that. So I think it would be wrong to make such a sweeping statement. Besides, one needs to contextualize the fulfillment or lack thereof of the promises that he made, because one needs to understand that when the president came, one, he found a sticky economy. Two, when he came in, during the period of the COVID pandemic, and then we've had so many cyclones, the worst being that which hit us last year, which damaged the road infrastructure, for example. And for us to put these roads back to use, we need no less than $5 billion United States dollars. But besides these things, the president has made sure that he, for example, builds new roads, builds new schools, builds health posts across the country, rehabilitates a railway system which hasn't been working for ages, and restore donor confidence. Right now, we have seen an increase in donor confidence resulting in a resumption of direct budget support. These and many more are pointers to the fact that the president is moving in the right direction. So yes, whilst the president might not have kept that promise, this promise, the not keeping of the promise needs to be contextualized.
The MCP last year in July said that the president will be endorsed by the party in August this year when you go to the party convention. Is this true? And is there plan for yet another alliance?
When you talk about the party endorsement of the Dr. Lazarus Chakwera as the Paris 2025 torchbearer, it is within the premise, the premises of democracy, that members of the party, structures of the party have expressed themselves without coercion, without being forced to. And what they're saying is that when we go to the convention, we are going to endorse Dr. Lazarus Chakwera as the Paris torchbearer.
Eisenhower Mkaka is the General Secretary of the ruling Malawi Congress Party, or MCP. He spoke with me from the Malawian capital, Lilongwe. A parliamentarian from Uganda's ruling National Resistance Army, or NRM, is calling on President Yoweri Museveni to step up the crackdown on corruption. Felix Adupa Ongwech expressed concern that the president's recent pardon of a jailed public official for financial malfeasance sends the wrong signal in the fight against graft, mismanagement and malfeasance. His remarks come after President Museveni vowed to soon expose public officials who steal taxpayers' money. This after the recent Auditor General's report show that the government loses over $1.5 million a month to about 1,818 ghost workers. Parliamentarian Felix Adupa Ongwech tells me that it's time for the government to begin serious efforts to root out graft and wrongdoing.
I take his experience's statement with content that it is done. reason being that last week he had pardoned the former executive director of NSSS, the one called Jama, who was convicted of corruption. And the president went ahead and used his power, a convict of corruption. So if somebody who has interest to loot public resources and see that even if you loot and you are arrested, at a certain point the president will pardon you. I think I did not take that statement well. Of course, if he's serious about fighting corruption, he cannot go ahead and forgive those who have been stealing public money.
Are you going to raise this issue with the president since you are a core member of the ruling party?
I have raised this matter several times, and I am still saying that if the president is serious about fighting corruption, he should act. So we should not be pretending that the corruption we are fighting because of public appearance, because of PR, and for the sake of diplomatic image, we must be seeing fighting corruption in real action, not fighting corruption in words and in pretense. We need those who have looted public resources, arrested, taken to jail, convicted, all the assets that they have matched to using the proceeds of corruption are all taken back. That is what they call fighting corruption.
President Museveni appears to be very disappointed by the Auditor General's report, which indicated that more than 6 billion shillings was lost to ghost employees every month.
The president said he's disappointed when the Auditor General released a report that there were ghost workers, but also the security, the sector that he has been trusting for a very long time, has got the highest number of the ghost staff. And he cannot tell us that he is not aware. We have been having issues of payrolls. He would have detected this matter when we started having ghost pensioners in the pension saga. That was the time to clean the payroll. If we can have ghost pensioners, it means that we have ghost workers. So it was upon the public service to handle this at that beginning of citing that there was a ghost pensioners.
So what do you think Parliament can do that can help in the fight against corruption in Uganda?
Parliament, they have done their job. They have been giving recommendations to those who are supposed to get out of public offices. But at times you find that even the parliamentary recommendations are ignored by the executive. You remember that the PS to the Minister of Trade was recommended by Parliament to be removed. But what happened later? The president decided to pardon the lady, and she's back in the office as the 2 years of Minister of Trade. Yet there was a lot of inequality going on in our docket.
What can NRM parliamentarians, the majority of you who are in parliament, do in terms of pushing your colleagues in government to do the needful by intensifying the fight against corruption or rooting it out or even attempting to do so?
You know that even right now there is a report that a trade committee of parliament has been working on. And there are members of parliament that have also been involved in corruption. So sometimes members of parliament, some of them are also beneficiary of this. Not all members of parliament's hands are clean. So now when you mix those ones with those ones who have not eaten, what do you expect? This is a problem. I cannot say there is no problem, no. I cannot pretend that there is no problem. No, there is a problem. His Excellency the President should come out and start fighting corruption in a very serious way. He should now leave talking. He should now take actions, serious actions about fighting corruption.
Parliamentarian Felix Adupa Ongwech is a leading member of the ruling National Resistance Movement, or NRM. He spoke with me from the Ugandan capital, Kampala. Gabon's military ruler says August 30, the anniversary of the day they seized power from President Ali Bongo last year, now will be observed as the Central African States Liberation Day. But opposition and civil society groups say the institution of a day to celebrate troops, as well as several benefits given to the military, indicate the junta does not want to leave power, a claim officials deny. For VOA, Moki Edwin Kenzeka reports from neighboring Cameroon.
Sous la très haute présidence de son excellence le général de brigade Brice Clotaire Oligui Nguema, président de la...
Gabon's Minister of Communication and Media, Laurence Ndong, reads resolutions of an interministerial council meeting. Ndong says military ruler General Brice Clotaire Oligui Nguema has instructed the transitional government to institute an annual Liberation Day on August 30 to celebrate its military. On August 30, 2023, army officers overthrew President Ali Bongo Ondimba and dissolved all state institutions. Ndong said Liberation Day will be in memory of troops who saved Gabon from dictatorship, poverty, and underdevelopment during the 56-year rule of the Bongo family. Ali Bongo came to power in 2009, following the death of his father, Omar, who had led the country since 1967. The Interministerial Council on Monday also announced what the transitional government calls special pay allowances for troops. Some members of Gabon's opposition and civil society groups say the new benefits for the troops may help the military stay in power instead of giving way to civilian rule by 2025 as planned. Clay Marshall Obame is vice president of the Coalition of Republican Citizens of Gabon, which brings together 27 political parties to press for a return to constitutional rule.
Nous craignons pour la suite de la transition. Celle-ci n'a fait que amplifier les inquiétudes.
He says the opposition parties in the coalition met this week and unanimously condemned the transitional government for giving privileges and undue allowances to the military. He says they see the benefits as an effort to gain the support of troops because General Oligui does not want to hand power to civilians by the end of 2025.
Se sont taillés la part du lion.
Obama said the coalition has written to Oligui to warn him of potential chaos should the military continue to receive favors while civilians remain poor and 37% of Gabon youth are unemployed. VOA could not independently verify if Oligui has received a letter of complaint. George Mpabga is the executive president of the network of Gabon's free civil society organizations. Via a messaging app from Gabon's capital, Libreville, he said the military government should be more open with the public.
Il s'agira également de nous impliquer dans toutes les actions de mobilisation sociale.
He says it is surprising that Gabon's military government is excluding civil society groups and the opposition from almost all projects it is initiating, when the opposition and civil society groups should be witnesses for the sake of transparency. He says both civilians and troops face hardships and poverty and should be treated equally. Mpaga says it is unethical for the military junta to give favors to government troops when all civilians are asking for their living conditions to be improved. Colonel Ulrich Manfumbi is a minister in Gabon's presidency and a government spokesperson.
Dans la mise à disposition des 8900 postes budgétaires, il n'y a pas que des militaires. Lorsque le chef de
Manfumbi says accusations that General Oligui wants to stay in power are unfounded because troops constitute less than 30% of the close to 10,000 people that have been recruited into the public service since the coup. He says a recent 15% reduction in the price of a 15-kilogram bottle of gas helps all Gabon citizens, not only the military. He adds it is normal to institute a day to celebrate the troops he says saved Gabon.
Sécuritaire au niveau de toutes les villes du Gabon.
Manfumbi said Oligui has constructed several hundred kilometers of roads, increased electricity and water supply, and reduced the cost of living for every Gabon citizen, not only its military. The military government also says it will build more housing for civilians, not just the military. Moki Edwin Kinzuka, VOA News, Yaoundé, Cameroon.
And right now it's time for music from our African collection.
I'm yours, your cargo, let's fly in your chopper. Hey, yeah. All you know, I'm a quad of tiny nadina. I'm winning my gumba, I'm sick of so. One for love, baby, one for quick, cause I want one yabba love, nigga. But send me a cause so. Would you mind calling your phone at any time? Would you mind?
character. Haganaga me a bad character.
Chameleon.
No bad character.
Haganaga me.
Pulling a moko fire.
We met a beautiful girl, no bada bada. Mkwano ya guleka, she no one, no bada bada. Oh, kusabi ya yori nakalema. Yesu viso mkwano, muna natele gulema. Mkwano wa ika nakalema nakolima.
Music from the continent, we hope you enjoyed it. Nightline Africa comes to you on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC from the English to Africa service of The Voice of America. And from the rest of the Nightline team, including producer Douglas Impuga and engineer Justin Thwaite, we say a big thank you for joining us tonight. And remember, as the elders say, a single tree is not a forest. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington, D.C. Good evening, Africa.
Le grand moulin R.
anymore.